appreciate you guys showing up on Wednesday late in the conference. Hopefully, I'll make a nice abrupt transition from very global, very non-specific sort of signals to very specific, concrete data sources for surveillance, namely snot that is sucked out of children's noses at emergency departments in Utah and sent to the micro lab for definitive diagnostic testing. And I say that not to bash anything about what's happening in the internet search world or in syndromic surveillance, but as a practicing clinician, the specific information about what's exactly going around in my community is far more helpful to me and my colleagues in making decisions and combating some of the fear and uncertainty and doubt that's manifest from all that hype of things shown in the media and elsewhere. I also want to thank the conference organizers and the reviewers for giving me the chance to come and present our work, and the chance to come to lovely Georgia again, the only state in the continental United States reporting widespread flu activity in the last week of August. Just saw that last week and couldn't resist putting that slide in. So when I say we and our work, I need to quickly mention the Utah Center of Excellence in Public Health Informatics. It's helped support me for the last few years, led by our fearless leader, Dr. Seymour. That's a partnership and collaboration between the academic centers in the university, biomedical informatics, pediatrics, clinical epi, high performance computing, nice partnership with our health department and Intermountain Healthcare, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a second, which makes a lot of my work possible. And then the Veterans Affairs Ideas Center, also located in Salt Lake. What I'm going to show you today really builds on what we've been doing over the last several years within Intermountain Healthcare. If you don't know about Intermountain, Obama mentioned them in the last few weeks about the healthcare reform. That's because they've been doing a very nice job of integrating healthcare delivery throughout the entire state of Utah and one site up in Idaho. They have a large market share with some pockets of activity where they're probably covering 60 to 70% of the acute care provided in emergency departments and urgent cares. 21 hospitals, over 100 clinics. A bunch of those are urgent cares where I practice occasionally. They got a large physician division with 400 physicians and a common electronic health record that they all put their data into. And then they have a very robust enterprise data warehousing operation. I put the 80 to 90% of the population figure in here because most of the population centers in Utah, if you haven't been there, are centered along this corridor. And Intermountain has facilities basically in all of those. The only place they sort of miss is down here in San Juan County. Moab, et cetera, where they don't have high coverage. Quickly, just talk about the data that is the substrate for all the reports that I'm going to show you today. Intermountain has adopted sort of cutting edge molecular diagnostics and viral diagnostic technology going back to 2000. We've been offering direct fluorescent antibody testing of respiratory specimens at Primary Children's and do an awful lot of that. In the last few years, multiplex PCRs for viral panels have come online in a few of our major hospitals, and despite us trying to discourage it, there's a reasonable prevalence of enzyme-linked immunoassay rapid point-of-care testing being done as well. All of those laboratory tests and the results of those tests get entered into a common laboratory information system where we can take advantage of them. This is a slide of the GermWatch system. We've affectionately called our system for tracking this stuff. I presented this at a couple other meetings, and I'll make this a fairly quick overview. Basically, you have a laboratory information system. You've got Primary Children's, my flagship children's hospital, contributing data there. A large hospital down in the southern part of Utah, one up in the northern part, one way down south, and then Intermountain brought on a large medical center in the Central Valley in the last couple years. These guys all have in-house micro labs and do a lot of testing. A lot of that's being centralized nowadays at IMC. And then anything that's done in the clinics also finds its way back in and winds up in this data repository. We are able to harvest that data less than 24 hours after it's collected and entered. So all that shows up in Uber tables in our enterprise data warehouse, where we can use it to generate reports off a reporting platform called Cognos, which is a IBM product, a business intelligence software suite. We also have ability to serve up custom charting tools that clinicians and researchers can interact with and query this data. And then we played around with some maps and map servers as well. I'm not going to go into much more detail unless you're curious about that later. We've been using this platform to generate weekly reports that I disseminate to clinicians and post on the web to keep them informed about various viral outbreaks in Utah. So you can see a nice black curve of an RSV epidemic. You'll see more of these graphs later. This was human metapneumovirus. We break it out into parainfluenza and a few other viruses as well. We've been doing this now for several years, have studied that and published some of that work that our docs really like this kind of information and think it's valuable to them for providing clinical care to their patients. And this is really the platform that we've based our H1N1 work on, so that in late April, when the first news came out about the cases in California with H1N1 and the ensuing panic that spread throughout the country, we decided to very quickly see how we could retool our platform to help with this response. Our objectives were to provide information to the key stakeholders, which included our public health partners, to the hospital and healthcare system administrators, who obviously were anxious about how they were going to track things and respond appropriately. And then my passion, getting data to frontline healthcare providers, emergency department, urgent care, intensivists, hospitalists, et cetera, and as well as the public to provide some useful information about what was actually happening on the ground. As I mentioned, we leveraged our existing platform. The timeline for this, luckily, I was on service that week. This was coming on, so I was there in the hospital, and everybody was in town, so we were able to, you know, get to work on this pretty quick. So we had some drafts of the reports that I'm going to show you in detail in just a second, going in late April, and had them pretty well QA'd and ready to start publishing by the first week of May. We did rapid report iteration where I'd sit down with the analysts, we'd sit down with our content experts in infectious diseases and administration, public health, infection control, and quickly sort of tune these reports to meet their needs and provide them the information that they were looking for. We tried very hard to pay attention to what those end user information needs were, and along that path realized that, you know, the facilities have different information needs versus the corporate level information needs versus individual clinician information needs, which I'll probably just barely, you know, skim the surface of. And then we made an active effort to disseminate using our existing channels to docs, where we have listservs going out to almost 400 clinicians on a pretty regular basis, daily during the early days of the H1N1, and then posting them on our web application as well. So we'll dive right into it. This is one of the first reports that we worked on. We realized right away that a weekly interval was probably going to be inadequate to provide people the information that they need, because things were happening really fast. Patients were starting to flood into urgent cares and emergency departments, and we wanted to give more timely data. So we retuned our respiratory viral report to provide daily counts. What's shown here is the previous 60 days of positive viral tests. The big gold line here is our RSV outbreak that was mercifully starting to come down during that time frame. Oh, sorry, RSV was gone. That's the black line. And then influenza A. This is later on in the season. You can see we're already out to June 12th here. Let me get you oriented. So the MMWR article came out online on the 21st and later actually distributed, I think, on the 24th. So that first news of the cases in the United States was right about there. Luckily, our influenza A from the seasonal outbreak was basically gone by that point. Our first Utah case happened right about here on about the 2nd of May, and then we had our first death here. So what this report proved to do, and would prove to be very valuable for, was to provide data that the patients that were starting to flood our urgent cares and to come into our emergency departments that were frankly freaked out because they had a fever and a cough and thought they were going to have swine flu were not actually testing positive for influenza. They were testing positive for parainfluenza type 3, actually, in this case, which causes a lower respiratory tract illness with good fever. So we were very quickly able to, you know, get our workforce to understand that we're not seeing flu here yet in Utah. This is parainfluenza. It was a powerful reassurance for families, and it was a useful tool in discussions about what to do about their sick child right in front of them. And later on, as it became clear that our testing methodologies, the DFA and the PCR, were picking up the H1N1 reliably, this became a nice signal for tracking influenza, and I have another report that we'll go into detail about in just a second. So a couple of the other things we did, and I have several examples of this. The point is not to overwhelm you with details about dashboard objects and the actual data that's on here, but rather to illustrate that once you have the infrastructure in place and you got reporting tools in place, you're able to use that substrate data in a variety of different ways to present data that's useful for line managers and other folks for their specific application. This one I actually need to come back to because it's a out-of-place influenza slide, but we'll come back to that. One of the things we appended to the bottom of those graphs was a visualization of what was happening in the regions. In Intermountain and Utah, we have regions sort of broken out geographically and around centers of hospitals and clinics. Primary Children's, where I work, is in sort of its own region because we're the main children's hospital for the state and a five-state surrounding region. But we have an urban central region, which is Salt Lake, urban north, which is the metropolitan statistical area that's further north of Salt Lake, and urban south, and so on. One thing to point out here is that we have this panel of respiratory viruses. If you guys aren't familiar, a lot of the panels now by DFA or PCR are testing for ever-increasing number of pathogens. So by DFA at primaries, we can tell you if you have RSV, influenza A, influenza B, human metapneumovirus, adenovirus, parainfluenza. We don't have rhinovirus. Rhinovirus actually shows up on these other lines because the Luminex PCR technology that we use actually has primers for rhinovirus, so that's why it's noticeably absent from primary children's. You'll also notice that the lion's share of testing being done in our system really comes around children. We do a ton of testing at primary children's because that data is useful for patient cohorting. If we have double bunking of infants, we need to know that one has RSV and one has flu because you don't want them commingling. That could be bad. And we use it to help with the assessment and management of febrile babies that get admitted to make sure they don't have bad infections. So that's one limitation generally about this system, is that the majority of our testing probably comes from children. It's somewhat therapeutic to put a little saline and suck some snot out of a baby's nose that's having trouble breathing. It's much harder for me to convince you that to undergo such a procedure to suck mucus out of your nose. And there's probably a general trend in resistance amongst providers that testing is really useful in the adult population. Most pediatricians, you can say, oh yeah, this is helpful, it's probably valuable. It's much harder to convince adult providers that it's useful. So a lot of the tests that are done in these other major centers are very sick adults that wind up in the ICUs or wind up in the hospital, and so we get testing there. But nonetheless, pediatric patients provide a great canary signal for surveillance purposes. A few other examples that we created, some specific panels. Our hospital administrators at Primary Children's wanted to kind of know what was happening in the last 7 days by virus. This kind of information was useful to them to know that, oh, things are finally getting better. We're starting to see influenza A drop off and life is getting better. It was also, again, noted that we really weren't seeing a lot of other viral activity at this time, which actually was really a blessing in the H1N1 case, because typically in the midwinter we'll have all these guys coming around, human metapneumovirus, RSV, influenza A, influenza B. So we get a smorgasbord of viruses, and sorting out amongst all those can be very hard. But this testing allows us to sift that all out. The emergency department wanted their own views. They were getting flooded, and this is even in late June. They were still doing, or mid-June, they were doing 48 tests in a day. Our ED volumes surged to levels that we hadn't seen before, and this probably represents maybe a third to a quarter of the patients that were coming into the ED were getting tested, and they wanted to know, okay, we're doing all this testing. What are we seeing? What are the volumes? So this was sort of a tailored table for them. So this brings me to our next big report that we came up with. This was our daily influenza A report. Again, once we were fairly convinced that our testing methodologies were picking up H1N1, we felt comfortable publishing this report and calling most of this activity novel H1N1, because we really weren't seeing seasonal type A anymore. So let me walk you through this very quickly. On the first y-axis, the blue line is total influenza A positive tests. So this is looking at sort of a patient level. If you were tested by DFA, culture, or PCR and tested positive for influenza A by any one of those methods, you showed up in that daily tally. If you were an inpatient, you show up as a red dot as well. Okay, so blue is all influenza, red is inpatient influenza. Shown against the secondary y-axis, and this green line is our volume of testing. So you'll see, right as we were coming out of respiratory season, you know, we were doing between 10 and 20, you know, tests a day for the system. After the MMWR article came out, we saw a huge surge in that demand for that testing, where we shot up to about 170, I think that is up there, tests a day being done for all the patients coming in wanting to be tested. And we were able to show them, you know, even with all that increased testing, that we're still not seeing a lot of influenza A here. This was all that fear and uncertainty, people flooding the emergency department. We had our first Utah case, and then things seemed to sort of settle down a little bit. First Utah death, and then we really started to kick in our epidemic here in Utah. And then we were able to sort of track as a severity measure how many patients were coming in getting tested, what percent positive, what was our percentage positivity, which is a useful addition that we hadn't had previously. And then a couple points along here, the testing recommendations changed, and we eventually saw testing start to drop off as we realized that everything people were seeing was H1N1. So that graph was useful for helping with those recommendations, those discussions about what to do about testing, what to tell patients. Again, a few examples of dashboard type objects. As it became clear early on in the H1N1 first wave that age specific attack rates were relevant. We broke out our ages to provide a table, you know, less than a year, 1 to 4, 5 to 18, and started reporting percent positivity by those age groups. Again, this is biased towards kids because that's where most of our testing gets done. You wanted just a quick snapshot of total influenza A activity for the previous day. These reports are still running. You know, I got mine this morning. I know that 11 patients were tested in the system yesterday, and two of them were positive, one in a 1 to 4 year age range and the other one in a 5 to 18 year range. So this is now a staple of our influenza tracking. Obviously, the hospital folks are interested in what's happening at my facility. We were able to tell them that at the Intermountain Medical Center, there was 4 inpatients, you know, on the previous day, no ICU that day. At LDS Hospital, there's 1, primaries are 12, so we can quickly give the hospital folks and the nursing unit directors and the medical directors a sense of what's happening at their specific facility. Again, more dashboard type stuff. This is just a different way of looking at age breakdown, where we used previous seasons norms to set the parameters for these gauges. You know, working with our infectious disease doctors to say what's sort of a meaningful way. The idea was that they wanted to be able to quickly look and see if there was a spike in any one of these age groups. You can see 5 to 18 here is, you know, pegging it, well, not pegging, but up to 50. 30 of those were outpatients, 2 of those were inpatients. So we're just exploring this kind of stuff to see what's useful. And generally, the feedback about these from the people that had that specific use were pleased with a quick and easy way to digest that information. Another way to look at age breakdown, we can generate stacked bar graphs that show, you guys have seen stuff like this here. And again, sort of by region, show me what's happening at the Children's Hospital versus what's happening in all these other regions. And then the last report, which was really a helpful tool for the very focused providers, the hospital epidemiologists, the infection control practitioners, now infection preventionists, and the state epi folks, was a very detailed line list type view of the case reports that we were seeing. We started this up again. We went back once we had the report working to go all the way back to April 13th. But the idea was here to give a line that, you know, the collected date, I blacked that out because this is somewhat protected health information, so age group and date are out. But what region they're in, what facility the patient presented to, did they get hospitalized or not? We did a quick and dirty respiratory distress flag using some chief complaint processing to say, did they show up in respiratory distress, something that we'd like to refine and see if we could do a little better. There was a pneumonia flag, again, using admit diagnosis. we were able to go look through charge codes in our enterprise data warehouse to see if the patient was charged for being on a ventilator. So it's a proxy for saying somebody got a mechanical ventilation, acute respiratory distress syndrome, again, using admit diagnoses. These are obviously not perfect, but we wanted to start and get something going and see how it worked out. And then whether they wound up in the ICU or not, we can look this up just by looking at the history of where, what rooms patients have been in and be able to create a flag about ICU or not. And then likewise, death is recorded in our system, so we can track that. And then we had which testing method each of these patients underwent. So for example, you have a patient down here who was at this American Fork Hospital. They were an outpatient. They had a positive EIA, but lo and behold, their PCR was negative. So we were seeing early on that the that our rapid testing wasn't picking up the true cases. Or was giving us false positives. Thank you. So very quickly, you can see what's happening from a testing standpoint. It gives those folks a nice view of how many folks are sick and where they are. And this just kept accruing patients. I think we're up to 30 pages or something by the end of the outbreak that we were able to track. So these reports were both fun and challenging, mainly challenging to the privacy board people and the administrators, because all of a sudden we were proposing to circulate information with some protected health information about these patients, and they wanted to know, who was getting them and how they were sort of using them. We ended up getting approval to do this and getting a sort of an exemption through our IRB and privacy boards, but it took a lot of administrative support to do that. But once we got past that hurdle, we were able to circulate a de-identified report similar to the one I showed you to a reasonably small group of individuals, infectious disease experts that were in charge of helping us with the response. And then we had an identifiable report that actually went to infection preventionists at individual hospitals, so that the ones that were actually charged with investigating cases were able to do that a little bit faster. It didn't replace Utah's influenza hospitalization reporting, but it was a nice supplement to it to make sure we weren't missing cases. And was useful for infection control in that regard. It's also useful at a corporate and facility situational awareness level to tell them about the severity, how many people were sick, were they ventilated, were they in ICUs, and give them an idea of what kind of resources were being consumed. I got a few minutes left, so real quickly, we built a custom page to help disseminate some of this information on our GermWatch platform. That actually was able to do in an afternoon or two. We turned this thing on, and we went from getting a 200 to 300 hits to the GermWatch page a week to it was like 17,000 in the first week. So people were hungry for information, and we had a conduit to sort of get to them, so they started looking here. We were able to supplement the kind of surveillance information with other content that was coming out of our groups, including a diagnostic treatment, diagnosing and treatment algorithm that we were able to publish and sort of propagate out to providers in Utah. Real quickly, success factors. Obviously, we have data. We got a lot of viral testing going on. That's may not be the case in other places. We have an integrated network, a value network, where all the clinical information is integrated throughout Utah. We've got applications for data warehousing. We've got business intelligence platforms for allowing us to generate reports quickly. And then we have great human resources, informatics expertise. We had a lot of help with content layout from ID docs and et cetera. And we had big support from our administration who said, yes, you guys go. They dedicated e-business resources to us and helped us really move this along quickly. And then the COE funding has been critical because it helped fund part of me and helped us build partnerships and relationships that were sort of critical for this. Looking forward, if the guy from the FDA is still in the back, making sure the primers for Luminex get approved so we can subtype and show our clinicians which subtypes are circulating in Utah. We struggled to get antiviral supplies. We thought we'd be able to get that information and publish it, but it proved challenging. And then we want to continue to work on refining and validating our methodology for showing severity for these patients. And I need to acknowledge a whole bunch of folks from Intermountain Healthcare. You guys need a Kent Korgensky. He's the key man, microbiologist, data wizard. He and I work closely, and he's responsible for a lot of these good-looking reports. Senior administrator, Intermountain, another analyst, e-business, our health department colleagues, ID docs, and the department chair in pediatrics, and then CDC, obviously. So with that quick end, I will take questions.
Nobody else, I have one to start. how big a staff does it take to, I mean, I said like knowledge base, but how big a staff does it actually take to get all the reports done, get the calculations done and all of that?
So the question was, how big of a staff did it take to actually get all this done? I'll have to answer that sort of in two parts. The database and getting the tables, you know, that goes back several years. That's work that's been ongoing. That required a data architect, somebody who's able to build schema, optimize tables, create views. That expertise is key. I mentioned Kent Gorgensky. He gave me two things. He gives me microbiology expertise, deep knowledge of the testing and how it gets done and the protocols and what tests are out there and how they get all those results get coded. Plus, he's an analyst that understands how to write SQL and write these reports, and he knows how to use the cognitive reporting tool. So once you get that kind of stuff in place, which is a lot, you can fairly quickly iterate these things. Once you get some of the core SQL built, you can tweak it and modify it, and then create reports sort of on the fly. Posting them, you know, a little bit of time from the e-business folks about how to get them, you know, online. That was, you know, e-business and a couple IT guys in the data warehouse. But that's sort of the core set of expertise, and the content experts, you know, flocked to it because they're interested and supportive.
Thank you.
Yes?
I'm wondering if code differentiation in your reports for in terms of A versus specifically H1 and 1. And the second question, if you can provide us with your vision in terms of data exchange for in terms of data types. Do you have formatted variables? Do you have standards? Do you use them? Or
sure. Okay, so two questions. The first one is about differentiating novel H1N1 versus other, and I'll do that one quickly. Like I mentioned or alluded to in my talk, we weren't sure early on whether the DFA was going to pick up this at all or the PCR was going to pick it all. That got sorted out pretty quickly as we got some confirmatory stuff going on. The Luminex platform that Intermountain uses is able to do some subtyping, but just to a couple subtypes. And the FDA has restrictions on them. I think it's FDA or CLIA. One of those organizations says you can't publish that back because it's not approved. So you can't tell a doc whether it's H3 or it's H1. We're hoping to get that changed. So the other thing is that the primers are out there. There's a whole bunch of primers in the chute to get approved so that a Luminex type platform or others would be able to actually then generate a subtype. And we're very optimistic about that. Likewise for the DFA, the company that does our DFA is trying to get that in. And we have testing protocols set up for going into this fall, and literally this information is going to come out in a few weeks, whether we'll be able to, you know, publish that out, and we're trying to work on our reporting infrastructure to capture that. Which brings me to the second question, which is data standards and interoperability. And I'll have to confess that right now we're not using LOINC, we're not using coded standards. This is very much a homegrown type of coding system. It's not one that we've had some impact on what it looks like and how it gets coded, so it's useful to us, but it really comes from our laboratory information system vendor, and we're sort of tied to what they're doing. And once they make that jump, which I hope they do, it'll be much easier for us to do this kind of work, because then we'll be dealing with a whole bunch of standards. So with those things in mind, I think I look at this work as, you know, yes, it's somewhat unique to Utah with our codes and the amount of data that's captured, but I think it's a nice example of what the potential is for a truly integrated public health information network, a data exchange network, using those kind of standards where you can, you know, query a set of federated databases and do the exact same thing at a state, regional, you know, federal level. So that's where I hope to prove value, show its utility, explore that as much as possible so that we continue to build the argument that we need to do this at a national level. Anything else?
You mentioned, correct me if I'm wrong, that because you have GermWatch, you had that in place that it made it easier to get up to speed to get reports out on H1N1. So I guess my question is there anything that learned from doing H1N1, from having to track H1N1 that you didn't know before because H1N1 was so big, or was the ready for, you know, is there anything new that came out of that experience?
So the question was, were there lessons we learned about H1N1 relevant to, you know, the GermWatch platform? I think the way I would answer that is, we were able to do some stuff really quickly because of that platform. In retrospect, I was kicking myself, why didn't we do this, you know, 3 months ago, 4 months ago? You know, why haven't we been doing this all along? Part of it's because where your efforts devoted and what you're sort of working on. There's that pressure cooker effect of having a panic and a crisis responding, much like what happened with the Olympics when we were able to do surveillance in Utah. Sadly, I think that points to the fact that sometimes administrators and sometimes, you know, even investigators and people in charge of this stuff need to have some external pressure to motivate them and galvanize them to do something that's meaningful and sort of transforms the way we do care. And I think that lesson we've learned over and over again, but you know, that pressure of having something to respond to brings people together and gets work done in an incredibly cool way in a short time frame, where otherwise, you know, you'd be dinking around and following these various paths and not getting people to sit around the table and say, hey, we need this just in case. These are things that we thought about doing for a while with the subtyping and things like that, but the lab people making those decisions about primers and coding, you know, they're not responding to the same things, or not interested in the same things we are. And this is a useful place to step into those meetings and say, hey, we need this because, and they're like, oh yeah, now I get it, and we'll do that for you. Yeah, we want to do that. We talked about it, but now we really need to push. And I think, you know, the FDA is going to be pushed to get that stuff out so that we've got that information available, because it's going to be critical going into this season if we get regular, you know, Tamiflu resistant seasonal flu A circulating at the same time. What are we going to tell our docs, you know, to prescribe and do? And that's much better done with local data than somebody in Atlanta or elsewhere making their best guess. That's my opinion.
I have two questions. One, who grouped us in the same group? And second, on a more serious note, you showed up the success factors, but I'm not sure how would you define success in that case. You have clinical indicators,
yeah,
and clinical findings, and you're distributing your information to clinicians. So is your success primarily, you know, business oriented, clinical oriented, and relates to public health or population health somewhere?
Yeah, so the question was about success factors, and I think that's a point well taken. You know, I quickly threw that title on there. I probably could have called it something more precise, like what do you need to do this? You know, success is hard to measure. We are actually right now, and one of my colleagues presented on Monday about a survey we were able to do in the midst of all this H1N1 stuff of providers throughout the state saying, where did you get your information? Was it helpful? We're actually analyzing that and writing that up. So I hope to actually be able to support the statement that we had some success here with actual objective data. Some of this is in the just in the anecdotal stuff that, hey, this is great, we had this, we knew where to look, and thank you for that information. And even, you know, emails from family saying, hey, this information was useful for me to calm down my family, that, you know, I didn't summarize and put in here. That's probably a little egregious to say success, but in the business operation standpoint is definitely, you know, one we haven't dived into very much, but this was useful for setting up our flu clinic and when they could turn that on and turn it off, and it really, you know, I didn't talk much about that, but it's helpful for coordinating, you know, the healthcare level response in ways that I didn't summarize.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your attention.
Let's get a great presentation.